Stephen Mitchell's talent of writing and transcribing from many languages is at first glance a pursuit only possible due to advanced academic studies. However, it was his Di education through intensive Zen practice that allowed for his profound ability to communicate ancient truths from his own poetic understanding. His rendition of the Tao has been widely appreciated, and his book, The Second Book of the Tao, put a smile of the Buddha on my face. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
In my intro, I wasn't suggesting my own Buddha-like enlightenment, but rather a simple recognition of truth and your abilities to interpret and write it, bypassing ego. It was definitely felt and appreciated.
Well, I love it that it caused a smile on your face, whether it's the smile of a Buddha or the smile of a mad woman.
Well, I guess maybe that's
equivalent.
Closer.
Smiles are good.
Can you give us a bit of historical background on the two sages' work that you've drawn on for the second book of the Tao, when they lived, maybe who they were and why you zeroed in on them?
Here's how the book started. I had translated the Tao Te Ching almost 20 years ago. I guess it was in 1986 to 1987. And it was a very important part of my life and still is. But I hadn't been immersed in it in the way that one is when one's working on a book for quite a while. And 4 or 5 years ago, I began a book with my wife, Byron Katie, that eventually came out under the title A Thousand Names for Joy. And this is an amazing book, a very profound commentary on the Tao Te Ching, and not only a commentary, but a portrait of what it feels like to be living in total harmony with the way things are, a life free of problems, a life of great joy, which is how my wife lives. And I would read her a chapter from the Tao Te Ching every day and write down her responses and then ask questions and suggest directions. And it was a wonderful project, and I was in constant awe of the depth of insight that came out of her. I shouldn't have been surprised, but it was an awe-filled experience. And so I was immersed in this project for a year with great joy and very exhilarating. And I came out of it wanting to engage with the great disciple of Lao Tzu, who wrote the Tao Te Ching, a man named Shuang Tzu. I had this on my mind actually for more than a dozen years, and I had never found a form, a way that I could dance with him, play with him. And one day, reading some old prose translations of my own of another ancient Chinese philosopher named Su Su, who was Confucius's grandson. He lived in the 5th century BCE, and Shuang Tzu lived in the 4th century BCE. It suddenly occurred to me that if I translated him into verse, there would be a greater concision, a greater wit possible. So I started to do that, and it was working very well. And then I thought, well, why not create a few chapters from Shuang Tzu in verse as well? And I began to experiment with that, and that started to work very well. Well, within 2 months, I had what I thought was almost a finished book. And then one day, talking to my old friend and agent, literary agent Michael Katz, I was describing the project to him, and he said, why don't you take it into the present and really get personal with it? And that led to the commentaries in the second book of the Tao. Opposite each chapter is on the left-hand page, And opposite, on the right-hand page, there's a commentary of mine where I elucidate or illuminate or contradict the chapter or go out off in 100 different directions and play 100 different kinds of games with the text. And that was wonderful fun. And there's a long section at the end, too, where I comment on the commentary and contradict the contradiction. So there are all sorts of wonderful Zen games that I was able to play with this book, and that's how it got written.
Well, the truth always feels very playful to me, and it's since it is hard to pin down in a linear way, it just really does lend itself to, as you just said, you know, in one place you will comment on it, in another place you will perhaps contradict it, and it always lends itself to that.
Well, it's wonderful it's wonderful when you find a way of being lighthearted and not every spiritual text has that quality. As a matter of fact, many spiritual texts are rather ponderous and take themselves quite seriously. So it's rare and wonderfully exhilarating to find something like this where humor is at the essence of it, and there's a wonderful lighthearted quality which I think is infectious, and it's great fun to read.
Well, Xiongsu, what was it about him that lent himself to this type of writing? Was his writing all lighthearted, would you say, or?
Well, it varies. The two original texts are grab bags, really. They're anthologies, and we call the author Xuanzu, especially of the Xuanzu, but scholars say that they're collections from who knows how many ancient Taoist philosophers, and you can tell that the quality varies a great deal. There are hundreds of pages of these little stories or philosophical riffs, and a lot of them are very dull, and some of them just are completely illuminated with a great depth of insight and wonderful humor, but it's a very mixed bag, and a lot of people who have tried to read both of these ancient Chinese dudes get very bored because mm-hmm. it is so mixed. The dullness is totally mixed in with the great vibrancy of the most profound passages. So I thought it was important to pick the best of the best, and only the clear, wonderful, humorous, profound passages. So what I did really was to anthologize something that was already an anthology, and make available for people the pure essence of these two great minds that were living always in harmony with the way things are.
Right. Did you find some of it ever got preachy? I know that happens oftentimes with spiritual writings. They can tend to go in that direction, and I have no experience, obviously, with reading ancient Chinese, and I was wondering if that ever fell into what was going on. And
I think occasionally that wasn't really the temptation in this tradition, I don't think. Preachiness comes, it seems to me, from a place where there's great doubt at the core, and somebody trying to convert you or trying to persuade you of something is really trying to persuade himself.
Yes, well said.
Unconsciously. So that's not so much the temptation of this tradition. The temptation is more to veer off into the non-essential and to be quirky and weird rather than witty and outrageously true. So you find yourself sometimes being rather amused, but knowing that the whole digression is pointless. There's a ring to the genuine. Something that you can recognize, and amidst something that's just interesting and witty and just doesn't go to the essence, you can always recognize that, it seems to me.
Right.
So what I did was rescue that genuine from the subsidiary.
Yes, that's well put, because once the truth is sort of stated or intended or suggested, there's only so far you can go before you have to almost take off into something witty or weird or, you know, existential. What was it about Sheng Tzu that had you write, "He had an audacity that could make your hair stand on end"? I love that image.
Well, thank you. When you're reading a lot of these chapters, it's really astonishing how bold he is in many ways. I mean, there are passages that are just are meant to knock you off balance. Anytime you think you've discovered the truth, anytime you come to a place where you think, this is it, I've got it, the next sentence or the next image will so take that rug out from under you that you just don't know where you're standing anymore. And that's the whole point. The whole point of it is to, through humor and paradox and wit, to invite you into what my old Zen master used to call "don't know mind," the mind that is completely open, that's free of its own concepts, that doesn't believe its own thoughts. And
well,
that's a mind of wonderful freedom.
Yeah, well, that whole idea about the mental construct, I mean, certainly his writings presented it, but aren't we all always presented that in life? I mean, whenever I feel like, I've reached a certain space, there's the next moment in time that shows me I still need to be in that place, in that moment, in that place.
Well, you're particularly open to reality. Some people get so stuck in thinking that that there is nothing more, or that they have discovered something that is, I don't know how to phrase this, but they've discovered the truth, that they stop there, and reality gets calcified around that. We all know people who are very stuck in their lives, and they don't have that flexibility that you seem to have.
You brought up something else that I thought was worth talking about, the golden rule being projected egoism, and I think that's the danger, in a sense, with any rule. Anytime something does become calcified, as you just stated, then there's that place, then it creates a place instead of a movement.
Well, I love the, there's a little couplet by William Blake that goes like this: "He has observed the golden rule till he's become the golden fool."
And yes.
That really expresses the dangers of thinking that that you found it. There's a wonderful story in here that I've taken from one of the later chapters of Shuang Tzu. I wonder if I
could
read it here. That concerns just this thing. And it goes like this: "Once when a seabird landed outside the capital, the Marquis of Lu escorted it to his ancestral temple, had the music of the ninefold splendors performed, poured out a cup of old wine, and spread before it a feast of beef and pork. But the bird became dazed, and it pined away, refusing to taste meat or wine. In 3 days it was dead. This was treating the bird as the Marquis would have liked to be treated, not as the bird would have liked to be treated. Had he done so, he would have let it roost in the deep forests, play among the islands, swim in the rivers and lakes, feed on mudfish and minnows, fly with the rest of the flock, and live any way it chose to. And so that shows, you know, in quite exaggerated, ridiculous form, what doing unto others as you would wish others do unto you can look like when that comes from the place of the ego.
I'm wondering, do you think it's possible to personalize anything without ego involvement?
Sure. The whole point of the Tao Te Ching in the second book of the Tao is that when we step out of the way, everything becomes effortless and life becomes extremely easy and extremely kind. You need to notice a great deal about the mind and how the mind works and how it imposes its own ideas onto reality. But once you get the hang of it, it's very easy to live outside that place of self, because you've seen through the irreality of it all. You've seen that there is nothing personal, and once you've seen that, when it's not a concept anymore, when you're actually living that, everything becomes very clear.
I'd love to hear an example of where you played with contradiction to one of these writings, perhaps.
Sure. There's a chapter at the beginning where I make fun of even the word Tao, and that's in chapter 3. He's talking about the Tao that can't be named, and the way I start that commentary is this. Who named it the Tao in the first place? I would like to talk to that fellow. I'd like to give him a piece of my mind. The Tao, the way. Imagine naming the unnameable. This may have seemed like a clever idea at the time, but it led to endless complications. Before long, people were searching everywhere for the way. Intellectuals began to wear themselves out debating whether it existed or not, or whether perhaps it both existed and didn't exist, or whether indeed it neither existed nor didn't exist. Scholars wrote tomes with characters brushed in the blackest of ink to prove that the way goes this way or that. Moralists determined what is on the way and what is off, discerning down to the minutest particulars exactly what we must do never to stray from the way. Thus, Taoism was born. But every ism is a wasm. It's already old news, an exoskeleton from which the living truth has moved on. And so on. That's one of the ways that I play with this kind of mode.
Yeah, which brings me into early on in the book, you question whether suffering is the result of confused thought. And what I would like to ask is, if we delete the word confused, is it the same question?
You know, I don't debate that. I say that this is what clear minds throughout the ages have discovered, that suffering is always the result of confused thoughts. And I don't think that's the equivalent of saying it's the result of thoughts, because there are thoughts that pass through our minds sometimes many, many per hour, many per minute, that don't cause suffering, that can be delightful. The difference is when we're believing our stressful, this is how my wife, Byron Katie, puts it, and she's, to my mind, the clearest of the clear. When we believe our stressful thoughts, we suffer. When we question them, we don't. So it's not a question of just thinking a thought. You can think a thought and completely not be attached to it, and it won't have any residue.
Right, so it's the attachment that creates confusion.
Absolutely. And it's the stressful thought, the attachment to a stressful thought, that creates suffering. If a thought isn't stressful, like, you know, the sky is blue, that's fine. It may not be true, ultimately, but it usually, in most sane people, doesn't cause any stress. So it can come in and go out, and there won't be any psychic residue.
Would you share a bit about what your Zen practice looked like, how you got started, and do you have a living master now, or did you ever?
Sure. I trained with two wonderful teachers, one a Korean and one an American, and actually my first book was written about my Korean Zen master. It's called Dropping Ashes on the Buddha. It's about Zen Master Sung San, who's a wonderful teacher. When the book first came out in 1976, I heard from various friends that people would go into bookstores and be very frustrated because the bookseller couldn't find any book called Dropping Acid on the Buddha, which I thought was a good title.
That's
as well.
That's a great title.
In any case, yes, I began practicing Zen in 1973, and at the time, this Zen master was practically unknown. He had just come to America, and he was living in a slum in Providence, Rhode Island. It was a wonderful, very funky little apartment, and there were just four or five students at the time that I discovered him. It was very intensive practice. We would do a 7-day retreat every month, for many hours a day. And then, as part of the Korean Zen tradition, there were solitary retreats. In the first couple of years, I did a number of solitary 100-day retreats where the schedule was 20 hours a day of meditation. So it was quite intense. And I think somebody as deeply confused as I was at that point needed something total and extremely difficult and extremely intense to just even get a measure of reality going. So I practiced for many years, and then I used to commute between Berkeley and Maui when I was studying with Robert Aitken. 3 months training, and then back to Berkeley for 3 months, and 3 months, and 3 months, and it kept on like that for 3 years. So I put in a great deal of time with this kind of intensive training, and owe everything to it, and think extremely highly of the Zen tradition. I also think at least as highly of the tradition begun by my wife. Her work is called The Work of Byron Katie, and it's an extremely powerful and very simple method of questioning the mind with four questions. And I helped her write a couple of books. The first one was Loving What Is, which presents her method, and it's very powerful and brings people to clarity with a speed that I've never seen before in any other tradition.
So what are the four questions?
The four questions that you ask of any stressful thought, a stressful thought like my mother doesn't love me, or I'm not good enough, or, you know, anything of that sort, the four questions are these. First question is it true? The second question is, can I absolutely know that it's true? The third question is, how do I react when I believe that thought? And the fourth question is, who would I be without the thought? And then there's something called the turnaround, where you are able to actually experience the opposite of what you deeply believe. And it pops you out of a reality that you're invested in and shows you a much vaster world around you. And then the thoughts that you're so attached to begin to unravel of themselves. Katie says it's not possible to let go of a thought because you didn't create it in the first place. But when you question it, the thought lets go of you. And from experience, I found that that's accurate.
Yes, and I see parallels with other methods, but using that method of questioning, in a way, it's very second nature for us to do that sort of thing. So when we have an automatic first question like that, it can dissipate the stronghold, certainly, that it has on us. And a breath can do the same thing. If you take a breath, then you can't think about whatever it is that has a hold on you.
Yes, but it's not the same thing in my experience. What has a hold on you will disappear, but then it will come back. Thoughts always do, because when we believe thoughts, they create our reality. And you may, get to a wonderful place of relaxation through breathing or meditation, but below the surface, there are those thoughts that you still believe that will be running your life. So in my experience, it's not the same thing. And only when you actually unravel the thoughts by questioning, by seeing through them to reality, can you step into what I would call real freedom.
Yes, and I like what you just said. They aren't really our thoughts.
Exactly so. That's very perceptive. Exactly so. Katie sometimes says that thoughts aren't personal. They're all recycled. What you're suffering from, everybody's suffering from, and truly it's not personal. They've been there, and they're there in every culture. They've been there for thousands of years. When I first did a version of Gilgamesh, the ancient Babylonian epic, that's the first sustained work of literature that exists in human history, I read that to Katie, and she had never heard of Gilgamesh, but she was fascinated by the suffering that was caused back in 2000 BCE by the same thoughts that cause people suffering today. So it's a given, and it's not personal.
This opens up this whole other topic, which we don't have time for today, of course, about mind.
Well, I hope people who read the second book of the Tao will not only find it amusing and enjoyable, but
it's a relief.
Find it a learning experience, and it's the experience of a very clear, joyful mind.
You state toward the end of your book that when you understand how utterly alone you are, it's cause for celebration. And I think many people could certainly use the ABCs on this one.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's solitude can be seen in a lot of ways, but through the experience of this book, if people connect with it, one way is of great cause for celebration, and I love that.
Stephen Mitchell, we've been discussing one of his many insightful books, The Second Book of the Tao. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting, it's iTunes Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.